Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 12:53 PM, the Pacific Summer Time, and today is October 16th, and today being Friday, it's a big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I was down at the port in Long Beach today, and one thing that was very clear is that the place was bustling. It's completely different to what it was 1 year ago. Back in 2019, the vast majority of businesses had pre-ordered their inventory for the holiday season. So by the time it came around to the September-October period, there was far less need for employees. There was lots of vacant areas for our loading bays. There was a whole row of forklifts that were just not in use at all, and there was practically no one around. And it could not have been more different this time. The place was bustling with activity. So we're certainly still in a reflationary period, and the activity coming out of China has certainly increased because a lot of those imports are coming in from China. There are two major sources of demand. The first is for PPE equipment, whether that is anything to do with face masks or anything to do with just the basic requirements of the healthcare industry. All of those factors are still coming in from China. Then there is the massive increase in demand for anything to do with home goods, like furniture, because there has been this massive exodus of people into the suburbs. Now, there are a number of different arguments for why it might be the case. Some people are saying, well, this is completely because of the coronavirus, and people don't want to be in tight quarters in downtown areas of cities because of the proximity to other people and the risk of being infected by the coronavirus. But there is an additional rationale, and maybe it's simply that the pandemic is an accelerant, and that the millennial generation, they moved to the downtown areas of most cities in a lot of different countries after 2008 because they were cheap. So the renaissance that we saw in a lot of cities where the downtown area was revitalized was driven by this migration of young people approximately a decade ago and all the way through until about 2015 or 16 when they started to be priced out of the major cities and then started moving to the cheaper cities. But a lot of millennials now are in their 30s, and that is premium family formation age. Most people these days don't really start family formation until they're in their late 20s or early 30s. So that's also a maturing aspect of developed markets. And it could simply be that the coronavirus has just accelerated that decision, because as soon as people start getting married and having children, well, then the need for more space and the desire to bring children up in a more wholesome environment, that takes over. And then it's really only a question of how long does it take people to move or to make the decision to give up the life in the city and move to the suburbs. So there's been an aspect of that, and that has massively increased demand for houses. What's particularly interesting, and it really does get to the very heart of this divergence between the winners and the losers from the pandemic, is that the price of houses has been rising, but the rental prices has been falling. So that divergence in fate between the people who can afford to buy homes and those that are stuck with renting, then it's quite, both are getting an advantageous position, because some people are just moving in and their savings have increased, so they can now afford to put down money to buy a house. Whereas people who are renting, then they have the opportunity to move and pay less. These are significant factors that are aiding the quality of life decisions for a significant number of people, but they are also a reflection of the impact that the pandemic has had on a very significant portion of the community, which is, generally speaking, the poorer people have been much more badly affected by the coronavirus than people with more means and also greater space available to them because of their better economic position. One thing I thought was particularly interesting, and it does, I think, bear quite a lot of relevance to what I saw at the port today, is that this is quite different to what we saw back in 2008. If we look at this chart from JP Morgan, we can see clearly that there were sharp deflationary forces in 2008. It took right into approximately 2009 for a rebound, and then we had deflation starting to become evident again in 2010 and 11. Part of the reason for that was because of the lagged effect of first the foreclosure crisis or the housing crisis, and then subsequently the foreclosure crisis in the USA, and then the sovereign debt crisis in the EU was a couple of years later. Well, we may yet have problems in the future, but right now what we're seeing is that inflation has in fact ticked upwards this year. These dark blue pieces of data in August are a lot darker than really anything we've seen since the initial rebound in 2009. So we didn't have the deflation. Instead, we're getting inflation. Now, obviously, there's a good reason for that. We've had this incredible supply of additional liquidity. And when we look at the total assets of central banks, then it has jumped higher during this period of extraordinary stress in the global economy. So that's a very significant factor. It's also been one of the primary reasons why we've had this rebound in stock markets. Now, I think what's particularly relevant is that it's continuing to rise. So that does suggest that there are efforts underway to try and increase the supply of money, but it's certainly not accelerating higher. It's nothing compared to the extraordinary move that we had in April, where the total assets of central banks jumped by $3 trillion in as many weeks. But it is now up to $28.32 trillion. So this is an extraordinary amount of money that is sitting on the central bank balance sheets of the world. And it's going to be very difficult to contract it. We've seen this incredible advance in asset prices. It's been predicated on the belief that this figure will continue to rise. Now, obviously, that is contributing to the bull market that we've had, but it is a bull market in almost everything. And we now have more zombie companies than at any point in the last 20 years. There was a bunching of zombie companies back in 1999 through to 2001, which coincided with the tech bubble. But the era of extraordinarily low interest rates has completely superseded the prevalence of zombie companies and just how extraordinary their valuations have been able to stay. And the rescues that we've had this year have propelled the zombie companies up into new all-time high territory. So at some point, it logically means that companies that cannot make money will eventually decline. But they won't decline until we see a clear change in interest rate policy. It's the availability of liquidity has been able to sustain companies at these extraordinary levels. And it's worth highlighting that this is the 2020 point, but the 2017, 19, 10, and 16 and 18 points are really not all that far away either. So the lower interest rates get, the greater the potential is for additional upside in companies that don't make profits. In fact, because of the convexity of the market and this is something that has been most often been applied to the fixed income markets. But the convexity of long dated bonds, and they influence that low interest rates much more, much less negative interest rates have on their valuations. It means that the price goes up a lot faster when you've got very low interest rates. There's always this marriage between yield and price appreciation that goes into the total return on bonds. And when the yield is zero, then the onus for additional upside goes towards the price, but it creates demand for fixed income assets because of the stress that is required in order to generate the zero interest rate. But we can perhaps also contribute or to apply the same logic to zombie type companies or companies that don't make profits. They are the equity equivalent of bonds with negative yields. Companies with negative earnings are basically the corollary, and therefore it's quite likely that as long as interest rates remain extraordinarily low, then we're going to continue to see these types of companies that will do well. And that also helps to clearly explain the outperformance of the private assets and hard to value assets, and those that don't mark to market. Because if there is no pressure on mark to market, well, then the value of those companies can continue to advance, and they're not overly burdened by the need for profits. Well, the sector that is most acutely benefiting from this kind of valuation metric is renewable energy, because by and large their profits are in the future. And the kind of business model, for example, that Sunrun deploys is that they will carry the interest expense and the expense of installing solar panels on people's roofs for free, and they can carry, or their whole business model is predicated on carrying that interest expense for years, because it probably takes about 4 or 5 years for the investment to pay itself off before they can start collecting the dividends from it. Of course, that is completely dependent on interest rates. So as long as interest rates remain extremely low, then the interest expense of carrying that that expense is very low, and they can leverage up on the back of it, and they can install more and more of these solar panels. But it makes the business model extraordinarily interest rate sensitive, and that is the unifying factor behind the growth of the renewable energy sector. There is this clear rationale among the advocates of renewable energy that it's inevitable that the quantity of money required to transition to these solutions is inconsequential relative to the potential benefits. But what is less understood, and particularly by the most wild-eyed enthusiasts, is just how interest rate sensitive that entire business model is. This, I think, is one of the most important points about momentum investing and the outlook for the global economy, because this way of looking at markets is not new. In fact, it has been working spectacularly well since 2008. And the people who took the biggest risks and borrowed the most money and invested in the most speculative ideas, obviously there is some survivorship bias, but they've done spectacularly well. And the evidence of that success has encouraged more and more copycats, so that whatever the venture that people are engaged in, then the business model is quite similar, and it is borrow a ton of money and on as leveraged a basis as possible in order to achieve success before interest rates rise. And it is the question of interest rates is by far the most important in the world today. When we look at China, they're coming through the coronavirus better than everyone else. And we can talk ad nauseum about why that might be and the success or otherwise of their draconian measures to clamp down on the infection, or the overreaction of the rest of the world to infection statistics and the unwillingness to accept even modest losses. But the reality is that the Chinese economy is coming through stronger than everywhere else, and inflationary pressures are beginning to rise, although inflation has been moderating as pig prices have started to come back down again. But the 10-year yield is rising, and it's up now to about 3.2%. Well, what that is beginning to price in is that China is going to be raising interest rates, and it may be the first country to raise interest rates. Now, when we think about China's interest rate environment, then it has a number of different interest rates. So you've got a deposit rate, and 3-month deposits are in the region of about 1.1%. But then when we think about the loan rate, well, prime loans are about 3%. So there is still this very wide divergence between loans and deposits in the Chinese economy. And despite the fact that they've been talking about narrowing this and creating less of an arbitrage, they haven't really done much to really change this situation. But the fact that the bond yield has been rising does suggest that interest rates will start to pick up as well. What we can also see on this page is that the survey for GDP growth this year is 5.5%. So China is going to grow faster than just about anywhere else in the world as a result of the way that it has been able to manage its way through the pandemic. So it is went into the pandemic in a reasonably strong position, but it is certainly coming out of the pandemic in a much stronger position than everywhere else. Now, if interest rates are likely to rise in China before they rise everywhere else, that represents a fundamental tailwind for the renminbi. We have seen a complete about-face in terms of the outlook for the currency over the course of the last few months. The fact that China is coming out of the pandemic better than everyone else is an additional factor that is putting upward pressure on the renminbi. It was looking increasingly likely that China was going to have to devalue the currency in order to combat the trade war. But now that looks increasingly less likely. So now we've definitely seen that they have even removed the penalty for shorting the currency. There was a 20% penalty for attempting to short the currency back in 2018. It was one of the measures that was introduced to try and arrest the decline of the currency. And that did nothing to encourage people to get out of the currency. In fact, we're seeing that because of the interest rate differential, because of the potential that rates may rise, then it is one of the few places that a government bond investor can go and pick up a high-rated bond with a reasonable yield. And that is not only helping to strengthen the renminbi, but it is creating less demand for dollars. Well, the dollar index has been rangy for most of the last 3 months. And when we look at this over the last 5 years, it's been a really quite volatile range below or at least mostly below 100. Now, we had a short-term oversold condition, so we are getting a little bit of steadying. And there are short-term considerations about just how much stimulus we're going to get in the short term. But when we start to think about the medium term, or indeed the long term, it really doesn't matter which way we come through the US presidential election. Both parties are going to invest in a reflation, and that's likely to represent an even greater amount of money being spent. The USA is already running by far the largest deficits in the world, and at 17.5%, if you add together the current account balance and the budget deficit, then we're talking about extraordinary amounts of money. The size of the stimulus being discussed at present is $1.8 trillion. But if we get past the election, now there is obviously an incredible amount of speculation about just whether the Republicans are going to lose outright, whether President Trump will be re-elected, or whether the Democrats are going to, or perhaps the Republicans lose the presidency, hold the Senate, or the Democrats win a clean sweep and take over all areas of government. Now, if they do, then there is the potential for a massive stimulus. So we've certainly heard from Joe Biden that one of his first acts as president will be to raise taxes. But that would represent adding back about half of what was taken away in taxes after President Trump was elected. So that would represent a headwind for the corporate sector. Then there, the other potential, or I guess if that's a detracting factor, then the contributing factor to a bullish phenomenon would perhaps be that they're going to spend even more money. And net-net, there will be additional stimulus. Because if we start to think about just how much money did the Democrats want to spend before the negotiations started, it was in the region of $2 trillion. In fact, it was more than that. And then they're also talking about a Green New Deal, which is an additional $2 trillion. So there's clearly the possibility that we could see $4 trillion in stimulus next year. And that also is likely to even further increase the deficit. So when we start to think about how likely is it that the dollar is going to rally from here, well, I think it's quite unlikely. And that a reversion back towards the mean would represent a shorting opportunity. And I think that is one of the more important factors, that even though the dollar is steadying in the short term, that any significant rally is likely to represent a shorting opportunity. Now, because the renminbi is strengthening, then that takes the brakes off of emerging market currencies. So the Asia dollar index has been trending downwards now for approximately a decade. But it rallied over the course of the last few weeks to break its sequence of lower rally highs. Now, we often see that gold and emerging markets rally together. Well, the gold price broke out in an emphatic fashion over the course of the last 12 months, and it is pausing right now in the region of $1,900, which coincides with the peak from back in 2011. And we may yet see some additional consolidation. And we've had a rebound over the course of the last while, and now it's been pulling back. We may yet see that it fails around $1,900 and comes back towards the $1,800 level. The one thing that, or I guess there are two important aspects to trading gold. The first is that it does tend to be volatile, and it overshoots on both the upside and the downside. So it's often it often pays to have bids in the market well below the prevailing price, because volatility can spike in the short term, and then that will create probably short-lived buying opportunities. So that's, I think, something to bear in mind. But medium term, there's likely to be continued demand for gold. When we look around the world, every central bank is adjusting their inflationary measures. It started off with the Federal Reserve. They've now moved to an average of inflationary measures. The ECB is beginning to talk about it, and the RBA today announced that they are also changing how they are going to report inflation. They're no longer going to look at a prediction for inflation and instead just look at the reported figure. So that is also likely to contribute to higher inflation. Every central bank in the world wants to inflate away the debt. We've been through a decade where various governments around the world have tried fiscal austerity. And the most important point is, all it has succeeded in doing has been to foster a populist movement whose primary motivation is to increase spending. So that has swept away the status quo. We're now in an environment where every political party is getting ready for even, or is getting ready to compete on promises to spend more money. So we're now in a period of modern monetary theory, which is almost directly analogous to what we saw with debt monetization in the 1970s. I think that's one of the most important points. When we start to think about that, then the kind of inflation that we saw in the 1970s didn't all happen at once. So that, I think, is one of the more important points, that when we look at how inflation picked up, it had a very significant rally all the way through the period from 1972 through to 1974. Then it came back meaningfully. Inflation contracted from about 10% and came all the way down to 6%. And then over the course of about 4 years, between 1976 and 1980, it got all the way back up to 10%. So we can anticipate that there will probably be waves of inflation, but that each successive wave will be higher than the last, and that inflation only really started to pick up in 1966. And it didn't really become so much of a problem that it encouraged central bankers to become extremely aggressive in trying to damp it down until approximately 1980. That's 15 years of inflation. And we're only at the beginning of it today. We're only at the very beginning of governments giving up on fiscal austerity and this Faustian pact with central banks, that if they spend, that central banks will buy the debt. Well, again, this is obviously something that is tantamount to financial repression. And the big question then is, what is that going to do to government bonds? Then one of the other points that I think is highly relevant is, when we, before we look at government bonds, to think about, why was the dollar firm in the period between March and June? Well, it was because other central banks had an acute demand for dollars, and that has pretty much disappeared today. So the easing of the financial stress and the partial reopenings has resulted in other central banks requiring fewer dollars, and that also removes a potential demand driver for the US dollar. When we then look at the bond market, well, we're at, I think, a very interesting time, because the yield is right in the region of the trend mean. It's been going sideways now for most of the last 6 months. The Federal Reserve is not buying additional bonds, and the increase in M2 is at a pace that prevailed before the pandemic. So it's increasing, but not by a lot. And we know that the federal government is getting ready to spend a shed load of money. Well, if the Federal Reserve is not buying more bonds, then it at least seems reasonable that investors might demand more than 74 basis points in order to be compensated for the clear intention to try and inflate the debt away. So far, it's been really quite inert and hasn't moved a lot. But it is rising. There has been a clear upward bias to trading or to the yield since August. That suggests that investors are beginning to price in an inflationary outcome. And if we do see the yield pushing through 1%, and if we see the 30-year, which is obviously much more interest rate sensitive, pushing up and through the 200-day moving average in a dynamic manner, which I have to say looks likely based upon the price action right now, that could quite easily act as the catalyst to spur the Federal Reserve into action. The one thing they've said is that they are not engaged in yield curve control. Well, I dare say we're going to see whether that is in fact true. The yield curve spread is edging higher. In the course of this period of the pandemic, every time it's got up to 70 basis points, it has pulled back and done so in a dynamic manner. The Federal Reserve said that they are not engaged in yield curve control, but primarily because they didn't have to. The bond market was pretty much doing it for them. But if long-dated yields break higher, then it is no longer going to become an academic exercise. Then they are either going to have to do something to depress the yield, or we're going to see that there's going to become a significant problem. Because if interest rates rise, that is going to puncture a hole in the valuation model for a very significant portion of the stock market. And it's very arguable whether the economy can tolerate that kind of pressure. The reality today is that there are five companies that represent an unprecedented high percentage of the stock market. The NYSE FANG index has done spectacularly well off the lows in March, but it is right in the region of its peak and it is pausing. Then we have the potential for significant regulation to evolve in regard to the social media sector. The way in which they've chosen to censor politics is going to be viewed as one-sided. Well, that leaves them with a binary outcome depending on who wins the election. If the Republicans win power in the next election, then it looks increasingly likely that antitrust efforts towards the extremely large companies is going to become really quite profound. I do think, though, that Google has already pretty much set itself up for antitrust by moving Google under an umbrella company of Alphabet and then setting up different business units inside Alphabet, then it's probably the company that could most easily be broken up. And certainly the Waymo self-driving company would probably represent a very significant IPO if it were to be hived off from the Alphabet parent. at least the share is steadying from the region of the trend mean, because you get self-driving as pretty much a free option when you buy Google's advertising parent. Then Twitter has also been very clearly singled out for opprobrium for the way in which it has been censoring activity. The reality is that they've taken a much more aggressive attitude towards anything that could be construed as political over the course of the last 4 years. And the potential is that we're going to move increasingly towards antitrust, or at least potentially anti-privacy. There is still a large portion of the internet which is anonymous, and a lot of the trolling that goes on these social media forums is anonymous in nature. People would probably have a great deal more decorum if their names were attached to whatever they say. I can't say that I really disagree with that potential outcome. Well, if we are then going to see the dollar decline and precious metals do better, the renminbi strengthen, then that is a green light for the emerging markets sector. Now, India announced a very significant spending program this week. So the Nifty index has paused around the 12 area. When we look at India's government bond yield, there is a clear conclusion that the spending measures that have been announced could potentially represent something that will be inflationary. So that may in fact contribute to demands for higher interest rates later. The 10-year yield in India has compressed considerably over the course of the last while, and that may now be over. I think the fact that we're starting to see inflationary pressures rising, and this very low yield that is evident on government bonds everywhere, well, we know that governments want to spend and are planning to spend a ton of money. It remains very much open to question whether the bond market is going to tolerate that. And we're going to find that out in the next while. The signs in the government bond yields all over the world suggest that we are potentially now moving into more of an inflationary period. When we then think about the MSCI emerging markets, it's been ranging for what must feel like an awfully long time. But it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of the range. The peak for the index was back in 2007, and since then it's been ranging below about 1200. Well, if emerging market currencies start to do better and money starts to flow towards genuinely high growth economies, then that should help to boost the valuation for emerging market companies. The ASEAN sector was among the best performers off the lows in 2008, primarily because they weren't writing subprime loans in the US housing market. The sector peaked in 2011, and part of the reason for that was because the dollar bottomed. Well, if the dollar is now peaking, then the potential is that the ASEAN region in particular will start to do better, because it will be able to allow its currencies to appreciate, particularly versus the renminbi, or at least in line with the renminbi. And it also has the benefit of demographics. So as we come towards the end of the coronavirus, I continue to believe that we are at the peak of hysteria, and all of this talk about a second wave is completely based upon the rising number of cases. But the entire reason for increasing the number of tests was to find cases. So we're probably really only finding cases in a more efficient manner now, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the number of people infected is in fact higher. That does not mean that we're in a new or in a second wave. If we were to see fatalities rising in a dynamic manner, then that would be more worrying. In between those two measures, we have hospitalizations, and admittedly, hospitalizations have taken a tick upwards. So caution is warranted before we in fact get marketable solutions. This week was certainly notable because Johnson & Johnson and Eli Lilly both paused their respective solutions. Moderna and Pfizer have not paused theirs. It remains quite likely that we're going to see a solution approved, at least in the USA, in November. But what we've already seen is that vaccines that were in stage 2 trials, which basically means that they're safe, have been already given to the general population in Russia and China. In fact, China is inoculating students getting ready to go abroad with their phase 2 vaccine candidate. So some countries are unwilling to wait, and out of an abundance of care, the most developed markets are waiting for the all clear in terms of the rigorous permissioning process that they go through. Of course, because the process has become so politicized, then the public information campaign necessary to encourage people to in fact get the vaccine has fallen by the wayside. So now the big question is whether they are even going to take the vaccine. Then what's even more of a factor is that in order to permission one, it only has to be 50% effective. So it's only likely to moderate the increase in the number of cases. So therefore, the rationale about lockdowns, closing schools, closing businesses, and inconveniencing or robbing millions of people of their means of making a living, these are all very significant factors that are likely to contribute to even more political polarization, because the disenfranchised are not going to take this lying down. And the only thing that is placating millions of people is access to liquidity. So what happens in terms of the bond yield and the impact that has on the ability of governments to continue to print money, well, then that is likely to be a very significant factor in 2021. But the Nasdaq biotech sector does have first step above the base characteristics, and that does suggest that it is in a new bull market and that the evolution of technology is most acutely being seen in biotech. One thing I think is particularly relevant is the way that the biotech sector has essentially been has benefited from having pharmaceutical companies outsource innovation to smaller companies. We're seeing something like that in the gold mining sector. The gold miners, which are generally somewhat larger cap, but it's worth considering that a large cap gold miner is not a large cap in any other sector. It's still a comparatively small market. They are being positioned into a corner because the cost of innovation in gold mining is extremely difficult. The cost of drilling programs is extremely high. So makes more sense to outsource exploration to smaller companies with the clear understanding that if they find gold, then they'll be taken over. There are a small number of companies that are doing that kind of thing. Probe Metals, for example, has bought a very substantial land package around Detour Lake. Well, Kirkland Lake Gold bought a Detour with the expectation of taking over its mine. So Probe Metals bought all the adjacent property with the intention of putting through a drilling program, and they're betting that eventually they'll get taken over. So that's a rationale that is quite similar to what we see in biotech, because biotech companies, they pioneer new drug candidates with the clear understanding that if they're successful, then it will get, the entire company will get bought out, and then everybody comes out a winner. Well, obviously then in gold mining, it's about, there are a number of different ways to play it. One would be simply a property way, just buy adjacent properties. A second would be with superior geophysics, so you get the big data involved. Then there is satellite data that could be parsed for additional information. And obviously then, quite whether that's proprietary information or whether it will become more widely available, because satellite data tends to be public in nature, well, that all contributes to potentially higher success rates in terms of drilling programs, because they'll have a better idea about where to drill. But their incentive to be innovative and to come up with better solutions and big data type solutions will all be predicated on the understanding that if they do find gold and they need the money then to develop the mine, that they will in fact have access to it from larger cap companies. And I do think that that is the way that the gold mine sector is going to evolve, because the complete absence of new discoveries of large world-class resources over the last 3 years means that there has to be a new way of dealing with this problem. So the fact that we are moving into more of an inflationary bias, and it's really only a matter of time before that becomes apparent, then the fact that in the absence of that clear inflationary bias, the purchasing power of currencies is going to continue to deteriorate, then it's likely that demand for physical assets is going to increase. Now, the one big missing ingredient for a resumption of a commodity-led bull market has been the oil price. And sentiment towards oil, I don't think it could be worse. There is this ambivalence towards the sector that it's just simply outdated and that renewable energy is going to take over, and that it is not going to have a future is, I think, the just the clear conclusion that many less experienced investors have reached. But the reality is that Brent crude is firming from the $40 area. It's back above its 200-day moving average, and it continues to steady. Now, what we've had has been a profound reduction in the number of miles driven. So obviously that contributed to the decline that we had in April. The clear intention of most people to be as far away from others in a closed environment has massively increased demand for vehicles. Well, that pretty much means that the number of miles driven is likely to increase over the next few years as we move out of the lockdowns, and as we get back into more of a recovery scenario, then it's quite likely that the number of miles driven will increase and that demand for oil will probably increase even faster. There were two, I think, rather interesting developments in here this week in the automotive sector. The first is that GM announced that they're going to start their driverless autonomous vehicle trials in San Francisco. And they're only going to be running 5 cars, but it's certainly more than zero. The share has done better as a result. But the other point is that Ford has had to stop selling its hybrid electric vehicles in Germany because they're catching fire. And Hyundai's had the same problem. And Tesla has had similar problems. The issue with the new batteries, the new batteries were designed to fix one problem. They've probably created a different one. The problem that they were designed to fix was the longevity of the battery. Most electric vehicles produced before about 2017 are worthless because their battery has degraded to such an extent that it just simply can't hold a charge any longer. To combat that problem, they increased the quantity of nickel in the batteries and reduced the quantity of cobalt. So now the batteries last longer. They can hold a charge for longer, and they can even drive further. However, they are more prone to fire. And one of the biggest challenges with these batteries is that it's not like a gasoline vehicle, that if you're in an accident, then they might catch fire. But that an electric vehicle can start, it can catch fire in a parking structure, or it can catch fire when it's being serviced, or it can catch fire during an accident. And it's the randomness and of that those kinds of events is something that could deter consumers. Well, at the very minimum, it's going to slow down the introduction of new technologies, and there will have to be greater attention paid to safety measures. Well, if they are investing more in slowing down the technology, then the steps towards greater energy density and longer range are also going to get slowed down. Well, that's also good for oil. And when we then think about the energy sector, well, oil prices are holding the $40 area. There is the potential that they will do better from here. The energy sector is right in the region of its lows. ExxonMobil today yields 10%. And the share is right in the region of its lows. Then when we look at Chevron, for example, it yields about 6%, but it is significantly off its lows. And it's also been engaged in some M&A activity. And it's a company that has been paying a dividend for a century. Royal Dutch Shell was forced to cut its dividend, and the share has come all the way back down to the low, but it's at least starting to steady in here. We are potentially at the low for the energy sector. The sentiment is apocalyptically bearish. It's certainly true that some of these companies are going to have a much more difficult time than others. I would think, though, that for companies like Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell, which have been transitioning to depending on natural gas more than oil for really quite a long time already, that they're likely to be in a better position to come through all of this than the other energy providers. And that U.S. energy providers are more likely to be beneficiaries than European ones. Methane regulations in Europe were also tightened this week. And that's just another example of how Europe, as a major energy importer, is much more alert to the need to diversify their demand and attempts to try and become energy independent. Europe is also much more activist in regulating the technology sector because the technology sector is not native to Europe. So these are clear examples of where we have greater regulation in countries where resources are not native, and then less regulation where they are native. And these, I think, are going to be more pressing points as we move through this period of increasing nationalization or nationalism and populism. Generally speaking, when the status quo breaks, then you lurch from one side, then to the other, before you eventually come back to the center. Well, we've had the lurch to the right. I think it is quite likely that a lurch to the left is impending before we eventually come back to a status quo that is completely different to the previous status quo. It does mean that there is a lot of volatility that it could potentially result from the US presidential election. And it's certainly worth paying attention to. The one thing, though, that I think is relevant, and it is going to be interesting to pay attention to, is what happens to the stock market over the next few weeks. Because usually when the stock market rallies into the election, it favors the incumbent. If Donald Trump is not going to win, well, it would be reasonable to think that the uncertainty that that represents would contribute to lower prices for stocks, at least until we see just how large a stimulus the next government is willing to provide. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.